Welcome to Legalese, a broadcast about law. Cass Bradley, bienvenue à Legalese, une émission consacrée au droit qui vise à rendre le jargon plus accessible tout en évaluant de manière critique ces institutions. I'm Gwen.
And I'm Amelia.
Your host for this month's edition of Legalese. So this month we have an IWD-themed, International Women's Day-themed episode for you with a focus on celebrating resistance led by Indigenous and non-status women who are directly challenging the state-backed systems causing much of the violence that they experience.
Yeah, so we will first play excerpts from the Tina Fontaine vigil that was held here in Jojage, Montreal, a few days after Raymond Cormier was found not guilty of second-degree murder for the death of 15-year-old Tina Fontaine. And that verdict came less than 2 weeks after Gerald Stanley, a white Saskatchewan farmer, was acquitted of the murder of Colton Bushy, a 22-year-old Cree youth. Both the Bushy and Fontaine verdicts led to mobilizations across Turtle Island, which many say have exposed the deep-seated white supremacy of Canada's colonial legal systems. Yesterday, we caught wind that the Crown is actually not going to be appealing the decision in the Bushy trial. Gwen, did you want to comment on that?
I mean, I guess I thought it was particularly despicable since the family lawyer said that there were grounds and had written a public letter that gave specific grounds why the Crown could appeal. So it was really their decision just not to do anything.
Yeah. And so I guess in a similar vein, we're going to be interviewing Jessica Quijano, the coordinator of the Native Women's Shelter Ishkwe Project, which is a program aimed at reducing and ultimately eradicating the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, as well as trans and two-spirited people in Quebec, which is very much in line with, even though Colton was not an Indigenous woman, it really speaks to the same kind of systemic indifference when it comes to Indigenous lives.
And finally, we'll pass an interview that I did with Guadalupe and Maria. Donc, on passerait une entrevue que j'ai fait avec Guadalupe and Maria du collectif des femmes sans statut, où elles m'ont raconté de l'organisation dont elles font partie, les réalités de vivre sans statut et ce qu'il faut faire pour que Montréal puisse devenir une ville plus sécuritaire et digne pour les femmes sans statut.
So, without further ado, we will start with some excerpts of the speeches from the vigil for Tina Fontaine, which was held here in Jojage, Montreal.
Amazing that people still wait and believe what politicians tell them, that change is going to come. We have been told that for generations. We were told that during the Royal Proclamation, which by the way is not an Indigenous Magna Carta at all, because the way Indigenous people have been treated in this country for centuries is that the police should secure the public from us, and that our security doesn't matter, to the point where children, Indigenous children, are being raped and murdered, and the justice system fails them, because there is no systematic coordination between departments to help in the child welfare system, that poverty is still an excuse for social workers to take away children from their families. And we know that the poverty that Indigenous people experience in this rich country is rooted in colonization, ongoing colonization. There is no excuse in 2018 for this. In 2004, Amnesty International Canada and the Native Women's Association of Canada released a Stolen Sisters report. And everything, I reread it this morning and yesterday, and everything in it is exactly what is still going on here in Canada. Nothing has changed. The rhetoric is the same from politicians. And the policing authorities still treat us as if we are not human beings. They treat our children as if their lives are not important. In our own homelands, this is our homeland. It's not across the ocean. This is where we come from. As Indigenous people, we are the first peoples of this land, of this beautiful Turtle Island. Canada is guilty, just as guilty as the people who killed Tina Fontaine, who killed Colton Bushy. They are guilty because they are not implementing any measures that provide security for the children of this world. They are guilty, and we as indigenous peoples, should be making complaints internationally because Canada fails once again. What does it take? What does it take? I want to know because I don't have the answer. I have been working in human rights for decades and looking at all these wonderful words on paper that talk about the inherent worth and dignity of a human being. But in Canada, that is not true. It is evident in what the decisions we have seen in this last few weeks of those who have been murdered and killed. They were put on trial. Their characters were put on trial, as if they deserved it. If we allow the government of Canada and its authorities and all the public sectors to continue this racist discrimination, then what does that say about your society? What does that say about your values and your culture? It is no different than 500 years ago when Europeans first came here and didn't think we were human and so declared the land empty, terra nullius, this doctrine of discovery. We know. We don't need any more evidence to show how guilty Canada is in the murders of our young people, of Indigenous women, of Indigenous men. Words are empty. Actions will demonstrate everything. The sovereignty begins with us as human beings, and that's what we are. We think about love, respect, courage. We think about honoring our ancestors. Justice for Tina and justice for all our sisters who are murdered and missing. Justice for all our young boys and the men who have gone missing. We have to make change. Let us all be of one mind, bring our minds together to make changes that we need for our children and for the legacy we're leaving behind. No, go, I'm trying to go on again.
Bunny, Johnny says, Tani Bussy. Tani Chani says, Tani Ba, Tani Ba.
Tina's story exists everywhere, and it's existed for generations. When I was a child, I was in foster care. My older sister was in foster care. She spent her whole youth in foster care, bounced around from foster care to group homes, to back to our mother. Our mother went to residential school, wasn't able to take care of me and my sister. And now, in this year, still working at Native Moons Shelter, I see the same stories. All the things where Tina fell through the cracks, through the police, through the hospitals, through social services, everything failed her. And her story is not unique. There are Tinas everywhere. And we have to do better. We have to do better here because this is where we all live. We see our women getting turned away from hospitals. We see our women getting turned away and our men from addiction centers, being over-ticketed by police for just hanging around. And then they end up in jail. And I think that it's really awesome that you are all here because you are all part of the solution. If you all go back and read Tina's stories and share with your children, who may be the same age as her, about what happened, and that they can also be enraged, and to do something proactive, that's the only way it's going to change. Let's try to have Tina's death mean something, that a shift has changed and we are not going to put up with it anymore. It's Canada 150. What are you all celebrating? We have to celebrate the people that were first here because we were so kind to you when you all arrived. We just want what is fair. That's what we want. So the message today is educate yourself.
We can't seem to do anything to fit into this society. Everything we do is deviant. Even our existence is deviant. We become violent. We react. We're criminals. We don't say nothing. We're apathetic. We die. We're disposable. Who gives a shit? I give a shit. I know you do too. If not, you wouldn't be standing here right now. But what are you going to do? Are we just going to do a vigil? Because words are cheap right now. Words are very, very cheap. I expect more. I do more. I'm doing more. I'm going to do more. I expect everybody to do more. If you are outraged, then put the outrage where it belongs. Take care of this thing. We have a thing called Gaswanta. In my language, the Turo Wampum. We've always maintained our boat. You have not, on your end, maintained your boat. It's time to maintain your boat. It's time to readjust and re-examine our relationships. 21 again. Nyawa.
Hey!
You just heard speeches by Ganyangahaga organizer and artist Ellen Gabriel, followed by Nakuset, the executive director of the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, and Ganyangahaga filmmaker and activist Clifton Nicholas from the vigil for Tina Fontaine held in Jojage on February 24th. In between, you heard songs by Alanis Abomsawin. The first was Niba, which translates into Hush Sleep, and Awihane, or My Spirit Weakens. The last song was by the Buffalo Hat Singers, who performed at the vigil. And before we turn to our next piece, we also want to welcome a new Legalese Collective member, Beth, who's joining us in the studio today. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
How's it going?
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. So Beth is going to introduce our next piece and give a little bit of context for that interview.
Yeah, next we are turning to our interview with Jessica Quijano, who is a coordinator of the Ishkwe Project at the Native Women's Shelter. The Ishkwe Project provides a wide range of services and does advocacy aimed at reducing and ultimately eradicating the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, as well as trans and two-spirit people in Quebec. The MMIWG crisis is deeply imbued in Canada's history and ongoing colonial reality. And while it has only recently come to the attention of the wider Canadian public, Indigenous women and girls have been going missing and being murdered at alarming rates for decades. In 2004, Amnesty International reported that an Indigenous woman is 5 times more likely to be killed than a non-Indigenous woman. The RCMP reported in 2014 that though Indigenous women represent only 4% of Canada's populations, they account for 16% of all female homicides and 11% of missing persons cases involving women. As many are aware, the Canadian government launched an independent national inquiry into the crisis in 2016 in response to public pressure. Jessica spoke with Legalese's Amelia about her work at Ishkwe Project, her thoughts on the national inquiry, and her thoughts on effective strategy in addressing the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls crisis in Quebec and beyond. Here's the interview.
My name is Jessica Quijano, and I'm the Ishkwe Project Coordinator at the Native Women's Shelter here in Montreal. The Ishkwe Project is a prevention intervention project for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and this as well includes trans and two-spirited people. Basically, I can just go in a little bit about how the project started. Because like we've had like a social crisis for such a long time, missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls throughout Canada. Here in Montreal, the Native Women's Shelter saw that when they would call the police when one of the women from the shelter had gone missing, how the police didn't take it seriously. Mm-hmm. Also, we work in collaboration with Quebec Native Women, and they did like a research a few years ago, and they saw that it's an issue that's not talked about here in Quebec. It's often like seen as a social problem in the West or in the prairies, right, and not here, but it is very present here in Quebec. So what they decided to do, and this took a few years, was they wanted to hire a coordinator to accompany families or loved ones when an Indigenous woman or girl goes missing, with the follow-up with the police. So that's like one of my roles. When I have a missing case, I like meet with the family and I accompany them step by step with the report for the police, the follow-up with the police, and as well providing them with any kind of support that they need. Mm-hmm. What has ended up happening is that sometimes families will contact me and they don't want to go to the police. So I will like try to locate the person without the police, because I worked for a long time as a street outreach worker on the street, okay, and I have certain contacts. So it's kind of complicated. It's not as like simple as it seems, just because historically the police and are not only like the SPVM, but throughout Canada were part of removing children and colonization, mm-hmm, were mm-hmm really the threat for Indigenous people, mm-hmm, and like what we saw in Val d'Or, like they're often were the perpetrators,
right?
So that's one of the aspects of the project, is that I like accompany families and friends to locate the person as well. Unfortunately, like we had two deaths of two Inuit women last summer, so I did the follow-up with the detectives when that happened, and we saw that they weren't taking one of the cases seriously. It was like ruled as a suicide very quickly. So we had to go to the media stopped, and now it's still an ongoing investigation. I also do a lot of...
So was in that case, were you able to kind of keep the investigation going? Because I remember, actually, yeah. I think you guys had hosted a vigil as
well. Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's still ongoing, but okay. Yes, definitely, because... you know, it's not only, like, the women that I work with are, like, often, you know, living in extreme poverty, might use drugs or alcohol, like, involved in the sex trade or sex workers. So it's, like, a real class issue, too. Like, mm-hmm. for a lot of the women that I work with here in Montreal, not to say that all Indigenous women that go missing are involved in those things, but mm-hmm. here in Montreal specifically, that's, like, the majority of the cases that I have.
Mm. Increases vulnerability.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's, like, one part of it. And then the women that, like, have been located, what I do with them is that I do a lot of prevention. So because they're at risk of going missing and murdered, we try to see what can we do to increase someone's quality of life so that this doesn't happen to them. Mm-hmm. So it's like maybe finding housing, maybe having them access to like social assistance, trying to see if they're in the, like, I work with sex workers in the sex trade, how they can work in like safer ways, like have more watch for each other on mm-hmm. the street. So it's just like at a lot of different levels as well. Like we work in collaboration with Stella, which is a vibe for sex workers' rights. So taking it at a higher level, like asking for decriminalization of sex work. So it has a lot of like different aspects mm-hmm. to the project where I work on a very individual basis with people. And then working with the police and the SPVM to come up with a protocol. My organization and a couple of other Indigenous organizations, Quebec Native Women and like the Aboriginal Network, we met with the SPVM to come up with a protocol when Indigenous woman or girl goes missing. Mm-hmm. So an example, like before, if you went missing, it would have to be the last person who saw you to do the report.
Right. Okay.
And because a lot of my clients are criminalized every day, mm-hmm. you know, it's like complicated. They don't want to go to the police.
Right.
So in this protocol, I can go do the report. I can get the information, and the person that gave me the information is anonymous so that we can locate the person.
Are there any other organizations or groups that you know of, whether like in Quebec or beyond, that are doing this kind of work?
I mean, as far as I know, this is the first project to do this because we want to set like best practices with police. And, you know, the idea is as well to do it throughout Quebec. So I've been working only in Montreal, but I'm going to be going to different communities throughout Quebec mm-hmm. so that people know about the project. We also are establishing the toolkit so that when Indigenous women or men, when they come to Montreal, they'll know where to go mm-hmm. so that they don't fall into situations maybe of homelessness or they'll get services. So that's pretty much like what we want to do. For me, the prevention aspect is really, really important mm-hmm. Because there's often a lot of focus of when someone goes missing or is murdered. And it's really, really unfortunate because it's not like we don't have the solutions. Mm-hmm. Like there's concrete things that can be done, but the government does not invest the money.
For people that are less familiar with the crisis, can you just set out, in particular in Quebec, what that looks like? And also why your mandate is so holistic and you're looking at not just when a person goes missing, mm-hmm. But also like addressing other systemic engagement.
Yeah. I mean, the crisis has been going on for like 500 years since the beginning of colonization. So it's not a coincidence that Indigenous women and girls are going missing, being murdered. I mean, this is all part of the government's way of putting different values of different people's lives. The way it's represented in the media, the Stolen Sister report was a report that came out by Amnesty International in 2004. They like put out specific things that the government needed to do. And like to date, those things haven't been done. A lot of times people like will ask me why Indigenous women and girls, but it's very intentional. Like, and if you look like historically through the history of Canada, this is part of a genocide. So I think it's important for people to understand that. And also, for the longest time, the government did not want to do an inquiry. A lot of families were pushing it. Mm-hmm. We know that the numbers don't reflect the reality because there's mm-hmm. a lot of Indigenous women and girls that are not reported. You know, like out west, what happened with Picton was more highlighted.
Yeah.
But this has been going on for such a long time. And there's also a lot of misconceptions that it's within Indigenous communities, like Indigenous men that are doing this to Indigenous women. I mean, there are cases of domestic violence, but the vast majority is white men.
Police.
Yeah, and police that have been the ones that have been the perpetrators.
Right, which also shows why you would have an underreporting of
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, as you were saying, a lot of families have learned to not trust authorities because, like, not only are they also perpetrators, but mm-hmm. they don't do anything about it when they are reported.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the Ishkwe Project is filling, like, mm-hmm. really important need on so many different levels.
Right.
You were talking about the inquiry and also the Amnesty International report. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is kind of a pattern where there are kind of a lot of reports written mm-hmm. where recommendations are set out and mm-hmm. it's like, we know what we need to do, but, like, it's not happening.
Yeah.
Like, Tina Fontaine is a recent mm-hmm. example of, like, there's so much shock and outrage, but this is, like, only one example of so many different, like, women and young girls yeah. and Indigenous lives that are just, like, not valued. I guess my question is, I'm curious about your thoughts on the inquiry, and mm-hmm. There, like, it's kind of come under fire quite a bit
for, sure.
for, like, a lot of commissioners resigning
yeah.
and for kind of the way that it's kind of been carrying itself out, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on what is working.
I mean, there's been a lot of organizational problems with the inquiry. I mean, they are supposed to get testimony from someone like myself on concrete mm-hmm. things that can be done. Like, mm-hmm. we wanted more people that are at risk going missing, or, like, the women I work with, to testify, but that's always, like, a challenge. I think with anything, like I understand that some Indigenous groups want to boycott it, mm-hmm. and I understand why some families want to go through it. I mean, they pushed for it for so long.
Yeah.
And I think that with any inquiry, we might see the effects, like, much later.
Yeah.
But it's going to be documented. I'd say the one positive thing about the inquiry is that there's a lot more social awareness about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Just that, like, mm-hmm. the fact that people are talking about it, that people know so much, because years and years ago, nobody really, really knew about it. And today, people actually, when I say where I work, they know right away.
Yeah.
So that, in a sense, that's how things are going to change. It's
yeah.
really not going to be with government or politicians. It's going to be with people.
People pushing.
Yeah, pushing if you see if any other issues that have been dealt with, like, in society, is because people were the ones who were aware and they decided to push this and make this a priority.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, and yeah, definitely, it's not addressing, like, systemic issues, even though there's been, like if you look at Tina Fontaine, I mean, she was in child welfare, living in a hotel,
yeah.
like... You know, this is, like, where women are not and girls are not protected by
mm-hmm.
our system. There's more children in child welfare and foster care than there was during residential schools. And this is, like, all these different displacing people, taking them away from their families, is all contributing to the crisis.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think, yeah, the government needs to listen to, you know, some very fierce, like, Cindy Blackstock, who has made it very, very clear, you know, like, when human rights groups are saying that Canada is really failing.
Yeah, and I think they just came out with their, like, a third compliance order or something
yeah.
that says, like, you actually need to do something about this and,
yeah.
and actually pay for this, because... It's yeah. it's like the number is clear. It's not even like this, like, kind of, like, peripheral, like, we know this discrimination is happening. We can tell you exactly by mm-hmm. how much children on reserves are being underfunded.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, you need to do something about that.
Right. And these are the women
yeah.
that go missing, that are
yeah.
in the child welfare system, that end up wanting to escape some violence from our system, you know,
mm-hmm.
that are in foster care and not get having good living conditions. And, like, with the inquiry, why it's so not working is because it comes from a colonizing way. There's no sovereignty when it comes to... I often say, like, you know, Indigenous people just need to get everyone to get out of the way. You know? They know what to do. Just, like, get out of the way. That's... not even about empowerment, and there's so many people that are profiting off this.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think, oh, bondage up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4!
Bye.
That was UK punk band X-Ray Specs with Oh Bondage Up Yours. And a fun fact that I learned about this band yesterday from my roommate when I was asking her about fun IWD music to play on the show today. This band, they're like a 1970s punk band, and their lead singer is called Polly Cyrene, and she's a woman of color. And apparently this band was doing their punk thing like long before the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the bands that are generally credited for have starting the punk movement. And so I guess in the spirit of crediting rad women that are doing rad work, let's give a shout out to this band and Polystyrene. So yeah, that was a little brief rad woman interlude before we go back to the second part of our interview with Jessica Quijano from the Ishkwe Project. Here's the second part.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, through Ishkwe and through your work on, like, kind of addressing this crisis on multiple levels, like, from a harm reduction standpoint and also, like, going through actually the police reporting process?
Yeah.
What are the challenges that you encountered, and, like, was there anything that surprised you from doing that work that it was just like, whoa, like, this particular concrete thing is really a problem that we need to deal with? Or, I don't know, any thoughts on?
I think, like... I mean, I've worked for a long time with, like, marginalized communities, like, people working on the street. So the police and their actions and how they treat, you know, they discriminate against people who are maybe living in poverty or homeless or, you know, indigenous, was not surprising for me. Sometimes I was a bit surprised how blatantly open it was, you know, that wasn't even, like, hiding it. Like, what I see often one of the issues with the police and other like system is that there's a denial that there's a systemic racism towards, and that the this idea that they treat everyone the same. But in fact, like, when a police officer tells me, like, so for example, I accompany women too when they've been sexually assaulted, indigenous women, or if they're living on the street and so forth. And when a detective tells me, we treat all sexual assaults the same way. Like, for myself and the people that I work with, that is a discrimination, because a woman who's been sexually assaulted, who has a home, who has, like, support, who has a family, to do the report, even though it's an incredibly difficult situation, there's support there, and she can probably go from A to Z. When I have a woman who's living on the street, and you're telling me, like, okay, she needs to go to the major crimes at, like, 9 a.m., do the police report, has to be sober, you know, all these different things. At the end of the day, you're not providing the opportunity for her to be able to do that. So how you're saying you're treating everyone equally is actually not true, because for that person, you're pretty much like, the system is just pretty much going to fail them.
And so, it's assuming that you're starting from the same place.
Yeah, exactly. So, so what we want to do, and this is like where we have ongoing talks all the time with the police, like, there's a group of indigenous organizations and indigenous people, we meet with the police, and we're talking about, like, changing a specific protocol, like having the detectives come, let's say, like, I work at a drop-in center at the open door, you know, like, so that we can do maybe the rape kit there, or we can do the testimony there, like, adapting practices so that they can have the confidence to go against their assaulters. Because I mean, a lot of the times it's just dropped. You know, it's not like the women, they don't want to pursue. And I mean, I don't blame them. It's really, really difficult.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of, like, cultural, that it's not adapted culturally, like that, you know, a lot of the women speak, they're from Inuit, they speak Inuktitut. The French is an issue. So it's just all of these different things that make it more difficult for. And so at the end of the day, it's not an equal system. So if you're like a, like, French Quebecois woman, you know, you'll be able to, you'll be greeted a lot differently by the police than if you're an Inuit woman who, like, lives at Cabot Square. And definitely there are some, like key people in the police who actually do care and want to see those changes, and they understand that, you know? So you got to just kind of work with that, work a bit, like, you know, who are your allies?
Can you think of an example of a systemic change that you think needs to happen in order for, like, say, like, an indigenous woman who has been sexually assaulted to have her case taken seriously and actually for there to be follow through?
I mean, it would be amazing if we had, like, a team of indigenous police officers or who speak Inuktitut and who were dedicated just for the West downtown.
Yeah.
and that's all they did. Mm-hmm. You know, we have enough like violence, unfortunately, that they would be busy. Like if the police were to put up like a job posting, like because there's always like these bureaucratic, you know, excuses. But if the requirement is you have to speak in Nuktituk, you're not going to have a huge pool.
Yeah.
Of like, so it's just having that quick link to make it a priority. Because Indigenous women, the violence against Indigenous women is like 3 times more than like non-Indigenous women. It just highlights that there's a need to address it. And there needs to be things that are adapted and put into place for that community. So these are the ideas that we put forward, like to have that communication, to adapt it in a harm reduction perspective. You know, I went to the inquiry, was the Vienne's inquiry, was the Commission on Relations Between Public Services and Indigenous People. One of the recommendations that I put forward was the Vancouver Police Department, after PICTIM, they put together some guidelines where they stopped criminalizing sex trade workers downtown. So to try to build relations, and they've actually been quite successful in that over the years.
Okay.
So there's like not, there's a lot of things that can be put into place that other cities have tried.
Yeah.
And that they can just like do that. Also trying to sensitize like neighbors and businesses, like the impact by always calling 911 because someone's sleeping on your front door or so forth, that can have like really devastating effects. I know that the government recently put out a campaign for the opioid crisis.
Right.
You know, like these are some of the things that, those are some of the things that they can do. I think that people knew the impact it has when they're constantly calling the police on someone who's living in poverty.
Yeah, for sure.
They might not do it. They might like maybe go talk to them. Like I say, just go ask them, like, you know, like you're making a lot of noise. Just like, can you, like my kid's trying to sleep. Like people understand, like have more of a human connection.
For sure.
But people are so afraid of like people who live on the street or people who use drugs and alcohol in public spaces. It's just very confronting. It makes people very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Which goes to what you're saying too about this need for like a broader like shift in the culture. Like we just need to be more human together.
Absolutely. And just exactly. I mean, I often say to like when people, you know, they'll be like, well, people, they drink and they're using drugs in the park. And I was like, have you been to a party before? Because people use drugs. Like I work for a long time on the street and I've seen more people get out of control at a party in a different class, you know, that might have more money there than, let's say, like on the street. So pretty much you're just saying you just don't like seeing poor people use drugs and alcohol, because people use drugs and alcohol in all classes. Someone smoking like crack on the street, to them it's like, oh, that person's a criminal. But you know,
but if you're at like a bougie like Wall Street party,
exactly, then like, that's
you're just letting loose.
Exactly, you know. So just so people reflect on that.
Yeah,
like their judgments are the internalized, like it's like we're socialized to hate those people, which is really, really upsetting for me, because at the end of the day, their rights are not respected. They don't have the same rights as everyone else.
Yeah. One of the things I was thinking about, kind of looking at like the way the TRC process kind of unfolded and those hearings, and then also looking at the inquiry, it seems to be like a similar kind of process of calling upon families that have already gone through incredibly traumatizing things and have lost family members to kind of step up. One of the criticisms I thought saw in the inquiry was that there wasn't enough aftercare, that like people were not actually getting, like, it's like, okay, like I've opened myself up and talked about this incredibly hurtful thing, and now there's nobody here to support me through the effects of that. And I just wonder, like, a lot of the burden is falling on families that have gone through these awful things and who are like living with this systemic discrimination. Like, it's not an Indigenous problem. It's a Canadian problem. Like, where is the focus, and the like, where is the focus on actors that are actually perpetrating systems? I don't know if you have any thoughts on, like, you know, we're talking about shifting the consciousness or like the public discourse. I don't know, any thoughts on that? It's just kind of an unfinished thought,
but. Definitely. I mean, I think that definitely people telling their story, it can go both ways, you know. Like I hear sometimes people like will tell me, you know, as a street outreach worker, I when I worked for a long time on the street, I worked with people who couldn't get services from anywhere, couldn't see a psychologist, couldn't see a social worker because of their drug use or mm-hmm. because of the instability in their life. So what ended up happening is that they would often like talk to me about their trauma, mm-hmm. you know, and like I would often get like, well, are you equipped to deal with that kind of trauma? And, you know, and absolutely no, like mm-hmm. I have training, but no, I'm not like a PhD or psychologist. Mm-hmm. But I mean, a coworker once told me they're like living their trauma every day. You know what I mean? Like, what does that even mean, you know? So I think it's really individual for each person. I think it's just to have the options out there. I think for a lot of people, it can be really empowering, telling their story. Mm-hmm. And it can be, I think it's sometimes very difficult for people to hear it. That's more, like, it makes people really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see Ishkwe going and what needs do you see it filled?
I mean, I see it as it's just really at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So we got funding for 2 years. We're hoping that it's going to continue the funding afterwards because we're not going to really see concrete results. You know, like that's the thing with government. They'll put projects forward for a couple years. Really need to see it for 10 years.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Be able to see what are the impacts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, I'm confident in the sense that I've seen how projects that started in community, how it's had a really impact on people's lives. So, you know, it's just doing a lot of advocacy. Now, the police is one aspect of it, but like trying to get other services available for women, you know, having a drop-in center, having a wet shelter, mm-hmm. Just like continuing, like coming here today, educating people on the issue. It's just like a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I think that till this like crisis is eradicated, I mean, it should continue. I mean, these services should be put into place everywhere in Canada.
Is there anything that you wanted to share before we wrap up the interview?
One of the questions that I get all the time is, how can I help?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. And I mean, this sounds really... I mean, just donate to the Native Women's Shelter. Like, that's what it comes down to. Whatever you can give, just, like, donate. They do an amazing work. They also, like, there's My Project, but they work with women and children living there, and they are preventing women from going missing and being murdered. Just places like that that exist, they are really, really doing a lot with not a lot of money. Anything you can give, like, is really helpful. Or, like, you know, there's people who've done fundraisers, or mm-hmm. this is like something that's so important, it's like should be a top priority to address this issue. So,
absolutely.
That's what I would say.
Great. All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You just heard the interview with Jessica Quijano, coordinator of the Native Women's Shelter program, the Ishkwe Project, which is aimed at reducing and ultimately eradicating the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, as well as trans and two-spirit people in Quebec.
And up next, we have an interview with members of the Non-Status Women's Collective of Montreal. So the collective formed in 2015 and have been pushing for regularization and for a real sanctuary city ever since, demanding non-collaboration between Montreal Police and the Canada Border Services Agency, Border Police, as well as access to declared work, education, healthcare, housing, and protection against sexual violence. For those who might not know, being non-status refers to someone who doesn't have an immigration status. So usually they've exhausted all immigration channels to remain in Canada. So, for example, this could include someone whose student visa has expired or was a refused refugee or came to Canada as a worker or sponsored spouse and had to leave their job or relationship for whatever reason. So I sat down with Guadalupe and Maria, who shared a bit about the realities they face, the changes they are pushing for, and the kind of solidarity and support that they need for that change to happen. And here they are.
Premièrement, ceci étant dit, les collectifs défendent son statut, si le nom est mis dans le thème sans statut, la majorité des femmes qui sont dans le comité, c'est des femmes qui luttent pour leur régularisation. Et ceci étant dit, moi aussi, je lutte pour ça. Je suis une femme sans statut. C'est un collectif qui s'est formé autour de beaucoup de personnes d'ailleurs, comme le Soleil des Sans-Frontières, le CTI, etc.
Merci. Et pour les gens qui ne connaissent pas la situation des femmes sans statut, est-ce que tu pourrais juste nous parler un peu plus sur cette réalité?
Et donc, la réalité est simple. Nous, qu'est-ce qu'on a? C'est juste, on n'a juste rien, en fait. On n'a pas accès à rien, comme les autres. qui veut dire, par exemple, je parle pour toutes les femmes sans statut. Puis les personnes que je connais, même les personnes que je connais, je sais qu'il y en a d'autres qui peuvent se voir pire que nous ou pire que je puisse savoir de ma connaissance. Mais sinon, je peux vous dire que, par exemple, si on parle du travail, on peut vraiment avoir de l'abus. Beaucoup de femmes comme nous, vu qu'on n'a pas de NAS, vu qu'on n'a pas un permis de travail, on est obligé de travailler n'importe où, n'importe quand, n'importe à quelle heure, le soir, la nuit, etc. Puis on doit s'habituer à tous les travaux qu'il faut dans le froid, dans le très chaud, n'importe où, de 6 $ l'heure, vraiment moins que les minimums. Puis aussi la santé. Par exemple, nous, on ne peut pas vraiment se permettre de tomber malade parce que nous, on a pas d'assurance maladie, on n'a personne qui peut nous soutenir. Ceci étant dit, on a le Médecin du Monde, c'est un organisme qui aide les personnes sans statut. Mais ils ne sont pas encore assez développés pour, par exemple, des opérations, des accouchements, des affaires qu'ils sont pas, ils n'ont pas les matériaux, ils n'ont pas les ressources, en fait. Par exemple, nous, on a un cas dans le collectif. Il y a une femme, ça fait 25 ans qu'elle est ici sans statut, puis elle ne voit pas. Elle est aveugle. Elle est devenue aveugle à cause de sa maladie de diabète. Puis, malgré toutes les luttes qu'elle a faites, elle n'a jamais reçu de traitements médicaux. Puis, c'est ça, c'est pas ça notre réalité. Aussi, ça touche l'éducation. Comme par exemple, moi, je suis une femme de 19 ans. Moi, je peux pas étudier. Moi, j'ai arrêté depuis que j'ai fini mon secondaire 5. Il y a beaucoup d'enfants, je sais, qui sont pas à l'école parce que l'école n'est pas gratuite encore pour tous et toutes. Puis, je pense que ça touche beaucoup, surtout les jeunes, aussi les adultes, comme les femmes, ils ne peuvent pas vraiment s'impliquer pour étudier la langue française parce qu'ils n'ont pas accès à ça. Je pense aussi que ça serait juste la sécurité, pour finir la sécurité. Ça serait vraiment plus important parce que nous, on est comme vraiment... on se cache, en fait, on se cache et ça... C'est ça vraiment notre logo. Notre logo, c'est des femmes avec des masques. C'est ça notre logo, des femmes sans statut. Puis je pense que c'est vraiment important parce qu'on se cache. Puis pourquoi on se cache? Parce qu'on a peur. On a peur de quoi? De se faire déporter, de se faire connaître nos statuts, etc., etc. Puis nous, je pense que c'est plutôt malheureux de vivre comme ça. Tu peux rien y faire sans penser de dire « Oh, ils vont m'arrêter pour ça ». Je sais, on a connu beaucoup de personnes que même en croisant la rue, la police l'ont arrêté puis l'ont déporté dans leur pays. Puis on a beaucoup d'exemples comme ça. Et on a aussi une jeune fille qui est allée travailler, puis son boss a essayé de la toucher et tout. Puis vu qu'elle n'avait pas de statut, elle n'a pas pu appeler la police. Alors c'est vraiment, je pense que c'est ça notre réalité à nous les femmes. Puis je parle de toutes les femmes, puis pas surtout toutes les femmes qui sont rejointes aux femmes sans statut, sinon à toutes les personnes qui n'ont pas de papier.
Merci pour partager ça. Et je voulais aussi vous demander sur la campagne que vous avez pour une ville sanctuaire. Donc, je sais que vous poussez depuis longtemps que Montréal soit une véritable ville sanctuaire et que Denis Coderre a fait une fausse déclaration finalement l'année passée. Et ça fait plus qu'un an maintenant depuis cette déclaration et rien n'a changé. Maintenant, avec l'administration de Valérie Plante, vous poussez pour que les choses changent. Est-ce que vous pouvez parler un peu sur vos demandes sur cette campagne-là?
Oui, nous frappons la porte de Mère Valérie Plante, mais maintenant, nous n'avons pas reçu encore le rendez-vous. Mais il faut parler avec elle pour donner nos revendications. Et pour demander que Montréal s'est décrété comme une vraie ville sans toit. Mais il faut faire des mobilisations, il faut faire des choses, il faut appeler aux politiciens qu'ils sont... Ils sont dans le pouvoir pour savoir s'ils peuvent nous aider.
Et pour vous, quelle est une vraie ville sanctuaire? Comme ça paraît à quoi exactement?
Pour moi, une ville sanctuaire, je pense que ça serait plutôt au droit à tout. Au droit à tout, santé, sécurité, droit, logement, de permis de travail. Je pense qu'on serait plutôt considéré comme tout le monde parce que je pense qu'on discrimine beaucoup pour être des personnes exclues de la société. Puis je pense que ça serait plutôt être plus considéré comme des vraies personnes. On va peut-être te faire juste un rappel où toutes les personnes qui ont un pouvoir tant que tel de changer notre vie, je pense que ça serait important qu'ils écoutent ce message. Je pense que vous avez beaucoup de pouvoir parce qu'on a touché beaucoup de portes partout et par ici. Puis la même réponse, c'est « Oh, on n'a pas de pouvoir ici ». Puis je pense que oui, vous avez un pouvoir. Vous avez un pouvoir dans les mains. Vous avez notre vie en main. Puis je pense que c'est bon si vous faites conscience un peu de juste tout ce qui nous passe dans la vie. Beaucoup de souffrances qu'on subit que peut-être pour vous, c'est rien. Peut-être que pour vous, c'est juste du blabla. Peut-être que si vous écoutez ça, genre après, vous allez chez vous, vous avez votre famille, vous mangez bien et tout. Je pense que nous, on n'est pas comme ça, puis je pense que ça serait bon de faire juste conscience de qu'est-ce que vous faites, puis conscience que vous avez juste un pouvoir pour changer quelque chose vraiment important pour toutes les familles qui attendent beaucoup de vous, qui dépendent de vous-même, puis c'est ça, c'est juste mon message. Merci pour nous écouter.
Merci beaucoup à toutes et à tous pour avoir de solidarité avec nous.
Je me demande... Est-ce qu'il y a une possibilité d'avoir une meilleure vie que ça?
Une femme vivait à Montréal. Elle subissait un cancer en étape 3. Au moment de son expulsion, elle suivait un traitement de chimiothérapie.
Un homme a eu un accident de travail. Sa main a été lacérée, ses tendons ont été coupés. Il a perdu la capacité d'utiliser sa main et il n'a reçu aucune indemnité.
Une femme a été frappée par son employeur au travail. Elle ne pouvait pas le dénoncer.
Un adolescent avait très envie d'aller voir ses amis à son ancienne école. Il n'avait plus le droit d'accéder. Il a été dénoncé et déporté au pays d'origine de ses parents, un pays qu'il ne connaît pas.
Chaque humain, peu importe sa couleur, sa race, sa religion, son genre ou son pays de naissance, a le droit de vivre en dignité.
Lève-toi et parle. L'hôpital, l'école, l'université, un travail décent ne sont pas des fruits défendus ou un paradis dont on n'a pas le droit.
Lève-toi et parle. Notre carte d'identité ne remplace pas notre vraie identité. À sa disparition, on ne disparaît pas.
Lève-toi et parle. Ce que vous apportez à la communauté est beaucoup plus précieux qu'une main-d'œuvre non déclarée.
Lève-toi et parle.
Notre dignité,
notre valeur
et notre sécurité
sont non négociables.
Lève-toi et parle.
Y sobrevivir para curar mi corazón a la mente dejarla fluir para el espíritu elevar y dejarlo llegar al fin yo no nací sin causa yo no nací para gritar canto para el cielo respetar, para mover las raíces de este campo y hacerlo brotar, para mover las aguas y el veneno verde que hay por ahí, para el espíritu elevar y dejarlo vivir en paz. Yo no nací sin causa, yo no nací sin fe. Mi corazón pega fuerte para gritar a los que nos mienten, así perseguir a la felicidad. Y así perseguir a la felicidad, que es un derecho de nacimiento, es el motor de nuestro movimiento. Porque reclamo libertad de pensamiento, si no la pido es porque estoy muriendo. Es un derecho de nacimiento, mira los frutos que dejan los sueños, en una sola voz un sentimiento, y que este grito limpie nuestro viento. Voy a crear un canto para poder exigir que no le quiten a los hombres lo que tanto les costó construir, para que el oro robado no aplaste nuestro porvenir. A los que tienen de sobra no les cueste tanto repartir. Voy a elevar mi canto para hacerlos despertar. A los que van dormidos por la vida sin querer mirar. Para que el río no lleve sangre, lleve flores y el mal sanar. Para el espíritu elevar y dejarlo vivir en paz. Yo no nací sin causa, yo no nací sin fe. Mi corazón pega fuerte para gritar a los que no sienten, así perseguir a la felicidad, así perseguir a la felicidad. Pido es porque estoy muriendo, es un derecho de nacimiento, es el...
Good afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.